You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're going to go back in time to look at a mass murder in the Heartland that impacted our culture and changed our country. Have you heard of the name Charles Starkweather? Well, an author has written a fascinating new book on his killing spree in 1958. By the way, that's the year I was born, and its impact on America. Are you a true crime fan? If so, you're going to love the book and today's show because the author is my guest. He's Harry McLean, and the book is called Starkweather, The Untold Story of the Killing Spree That Changed America. Harry, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be with you, Robin.
Well, this is fascinating, and it's not a typical topic for my show, but I think, as my listeners know, I mean, politics is culture, and culture is politics, and you make a convincing case how this changed America, American culture, and we'll get to that. But first, for our listeners who may not be aware of Charles Starkweather, and I'll admit that I wasn't, start out here and talk about him and his upbringing and what led him to this these tragic events.
Charlie was born in 1938. He was short, a little under 5'5", flaming red hair, bow-legged, picked on as a child, came from a substantial family in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is where most of the events in the story take place. He responded to this in kind of shorthand by developing a temper and a sociopathic personality that allowed him to really kill without remorse or feeling. And he went on a rampage in starting in the January of 1958 that ended up with 10 people murdered in Nebraska and eventually in Wyoming, where he was captured. And with him was his girlfriend, Carol Fugate, who was 14 years old at the time. Charlie was 19 at the time. Carol was 14, and she accompanied him on the killing spree. But her involvement, her culpability, has always been a major question in the course of events. Charlie was convicted of murder and died by electrocution 15 months after his conviction. Carol was convicted of murder as well. She was 15 when she was finally tried, and she served 17 years in prison and is now out of prison.
These killings, I hate to say it, but in our society now, we're kind of used to it. I hate to say that, but I think it's true. We have these a lot, but take us back. I think your book starts out, and it's really interesting how you set the stage in describing America back then. Take us back then to a typical Heartland city here and what it was like, that area, before these terrible events took place.
Well, Lincoln, Nebraska at the time was about 128,000. I lived there at the time, as did my family. And I described it as a big, small town. It was a small town that had a lot of people in it, but its flavor, its values was pretty much as a small town. And Nebraska and the country at that time in 1958 was still in the last glow, afterglow of World War II. They had come out victors with the strongest economy, the strongest military the world had ever seen. They were at peace. Grandfather Eisenhower was taking care of them, just like he'd taken care of them in World War II. And life was pretty, all the vets had come back. A lot of them had gone to college, left the farm. They were in the cities. The middle class was developing, had developed in these years. And it so that you had larger families, you had two cars, and television had just hit big time. By 1958, you had 85% of the homes in the country had television. And life was predictable. I remember it back then. I grew up in the 50s, and people make fun of the 50s a lot. So it's kind of a myth that it was peaceful and easy time to live. But it was. Take my word for it. There were problems, of course, with civil rights and women's rights and so forth that were ready to boil to the surface, and they did a few years later. But at that time, life made sense. If you worked, if you got married, if you had kids, if you went to church, if you played by the rules, life would work for you. And it did for most people in the middle class. But they were upwardly mobile. You know, I never had a lock in my car, on my house, on my bike. To the extent there were murders, homicides in that time period, they were mainly domestic violence or robberies or two guys with a grudge against each other or some sort of gang related theft. The idea of random murders for the sake of murder had not yet entered the culture, at least in the modern age. There were a couple of them in the 20s, but in terms of modern America, it was an unknown phenomena. And Charlie made it a known phenomena. His rampage was basically, he wasn't particularly angry. He wasn't out to punish people. He wasn't on some mission of revenge. He did it because he believed, as a sociopath, that it would make him feel better. To oversimplify it, he thought it would be, he had a fantasy himself as an outlaw with a gang, and he was just as happy to go out in a blaze of glory as long as his girlfriend was sitting on his lap. So when Carol entered the picture, the fantasy was complete, and he went on the rage of terror, killing basically innocent people that he didn't know. And that, the rampage went on for 8 days, and it captivated the entire nation, because Huntley Brinkley picked it up, ran it every night. Television had just hooked up, so you could have the national network could carry the affiliate in Lincoln live. So in their rooms, in their living room, at their dining room table, they were now watching Charlie come out of the courthouse in cuffs after a hearing, or Carol go into the courthouse. So people were watching at night. Huntley himself was captivated by it. You could see it. And that pulled television into the story. The first time really that violence and television had met each other, and they loved each other. It was a match made in hell, but everybody loved it. It was like a movie that was taking place in your living room. And that kind of set off what you see today, which is, you know, true crime is the second biggest genre in books after romance. And the true crime shows on television are 24 hours a day. So that was the impact. Then just to kind of finish that idea, what Charlie did in terms of the culture was demonstrate to sociopaths, psychopaths, that there was a better way. There was another way to act out the pathology. You didn't have to sit in the basement and stick pins in your mother and then go up and cut her head off, stick it in the freezer. You could walk out your door and you could start shooting people. Not only would you act out your pathology, you would become famous. You'd be on television, there'd be movies about you, everybody would know your name. He opened that door to what you were saying, which is now such a common phenomena. We barely make note of a lot of them that happened. But in the aftermath of this, you had Whitman, who sat up in the tower of at the University of Texas in Austin and shot 22 people to death that he didn't know randomly. So Charlie kicked off that phenomena, in this country, in my view, and we're still living with it today.
You, for listeners, again, I Harry does a masterful job at kind of laying out the times, which you just talked about here a little bit. Then he goes into the conflicts between the stories between Charles Starkweather and Carol Fugate. But I'm interested in how, and I don't want to give away too much of the book, but the question you immediately ask is why? Why did he do this? And you speculate a little bit, but they had psychiatrists from both sides coming into the trial. And I saw where he was kind of bullied as a kid. Is that as good of explanation as any for what triggered all this? Or what are your thoughts?
You know, a psychologist friend of mine, I think, came up with the right word for the impact of that bullying. And he was viciously bullied. There's no question about that. I talked to people who were in school with him at the time. Well, my older brother was in school with him. And it was vicious. And you know how kids can be. And he put up with it for a while. But the word that is used to describe the impact of that behavior on his eventual reign of terror is that it contributed to it as opposed to caused it, because there are many people who are subject to the same sort of bullying who don't end up being psychopathic killers. But it certainly was a part of who he was, and he was playing out his reaction to that when he did pick up a gun and start shooting people. Absolutely.
It's interesting that Starkweather was really loving the attention, and several times you draw an analogy with James Dean, who had just died tragically several years earlier. And for our listeners, again, that were unaware, I want to reemphasize the point you made. He had this picture in his mind. He was going to go out in a blaze of glory, and he saw himself as kind of, he was a little, when you see the pictures in the book, kind of James Dean-like a little bit in appearance.
Yeah, he was. And he, you know, whenever a James Dean movie came to town, he saw it three or four or five times. And he had his attitude, his physical attitude, his the way he looked, the way he held himself down. So when you see pictures of him after he's been arrested, he is not particularly concerned about being arrested. He confessed to everything right away. The minute they got him, they even confessed to one murder they didn't know about. Because now he had moved into, his fantasy had moved into reality. And when you see pictures of him, he's got the pose, he's got the cigarette hanging out the left side of his mouth. If you go back and look at Giants in those movies, you'll see James Dean, Rebel Without a Cause is really where he starts to do it. And he hangs it out of the left corner of his mouth and kind of has a shrugging look on his shoulders and head, and he's you know, being led down the stairs in handcuffs, and that's the thing that's most important to him, is to project this image of James Dean.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today, very pleased to have as my guest, Harry McLean, who's written a brand new book called Starkweather, The Untold Story of the Killing Spree That Changed America. It's kind of a different topic for our show, but I think it's very relevant for the impact this had on our country and our culture, which I want to turn to a little bit here. I'll just say, add another point of personal reference here. This occurred again, as I said, at the beginning of 1958, the year I was born. I remember a similar type a mass killing in Chicago. I was born and raised in Chicago, and I think it was in the mid-60s when I was a young kid, Richard Speck killed, I think it was 8 nurses for no apparent reason up in Chicago. And I remember the fear, my parents, I mean, locking the doors and stuff. That's what took place in this calm, bucolic Midwestern city of Lincoln during these days when Starkweather was on the loose. And you have pictures, too, the National Guard being pulled out. Describe what that was like. I mean, what a shock to a community like this that, again, still has repercussions today.
Well, they couldn't catch him. The cops were at least one crime scene behind. Sometimes they were two crime scenes behind. It was almost kind of comedic in how inept they were. And during this whole series of murders in different towns, nobody ever saw Charlie or Carol. He became this kind of ghost-like figure but he would be in your garage when you came home and he'd pull out a shotgun and blow your head off with it. So people, the terror was that they didn't know where he was. Whenever they thought he was left, he would be in Lincoln. When they thought he was in Lincoln, he would have left. And so this fear that you didn't know where he was, and so therefore you couldn't be safe as long as you were, spread to Iowa, spread to Kansas, spread to South Dakota, spread to even Eastern Colorado was part of the terror that went on for this time period. And what the kids, they shut down the schools. Parents came armed with shotguns and rifles to the school to pick their kids up. There were vigilantes driving around in town with their rifles sticking out the window, looking for redheaded people. It was getting kind of risky at the end there. But the thing, and I can still, you can talk to people that were 7, 8, 9 years old at the time. And the thing that terrified these kids the most was the look on their parents' face. They would look at their dad, who was an architect or a doctor, and he'd be terrified. A look that they had never seen before. And to this day, when you talk to them and take them back through that event in their childhood, some of them actually kind of start to relive it in a PTSD sort of way. They start to like shake their voice, starts to quiver as they go back to that time period and relive the fear that they felt when Charlie was on the loose.
Harry, you really interesting personal angle to this. You talked about being raised in that area back in the late 50s, but you also pursue this case with all the details of it and how the stories begin to diverge between the two main protagonists. You talk in the book again about what you think really happened. And I just have to say, ask, do you think Carol Fugate was treated fairly in this trial and the aftermath? And please include how you wound up actually meeting her, which you describe in the book.
When I got in, I had walked away from this story. I've written other true crime books, and I had walked up to it because it was in my hometown. I knew a lot of the people, and I always walked away from it. Finally, a couple years ago, Carol asked for a pardon, and it was denied. And I was kind of writing a fiction book at the time and thought, weaving a stark weather theme into it. And I said, well, I'm going to go on YouTube and actually look at her, because I know she's always said she was innocent. And the people, the press, the cops, everybody in Nebraska thought she was guilty. She was convicted before she ever came to trial. But so I watched her on there as on a current affairs show. And she was as convincing as any human being I've ever seen that she was innocent. And I thought, that's the hook that's finally going to pull me in, because I am a lawyer and a former judge. And I thought, that's the hook that's irresistible to me now. Is she guilty or is she innocent? What are the facts? Not what your supposition, not what are your inferences, not what your speculation is. What are the facts as if she was standing trial? So that's a main theme in the book. As a matter of fact, someone the other day said the book is as much about Carol as it is about Starkweather. And there's a lot of truth to that, because she's never been taken seriously as a defendant. And remember, she was 14 years old. She could have been put to death. The same jury that convicted her could have turned around 5 minutes later and said, she's going to die. They didn't, but she could have. She was treated very unfairly, not so much intentionally, but it was the whole system was pretty primitive back then. It's hard to imagine it. But they weren't used to any female juveniles in the first place, and any girls coming in charged with crime. So the system wasn't set up to deal with it. They had no facilities for her, jail facilities. So she ended up in a mental hospital for 6-7 months before she came to trial. She wasn't treated, but she was kind of warehoused there. She was interrogated mercilessly by the police when she and Charlie were captured up in Douglas, Wyoming, without a lawyer, without a parent. Her parents were dead at that point. Charlie had killed them both, as well as her little sister. There was no one in her corner when they interrogated her for over 15 hours, and they got a confession from her. It's the cops called it a confession. It's more of a statement. And that's what they tried her on for this one crime. But if you go back and read the press, the assumption of her guilt was so overwhelming and so wound into every recitation of the facts of the story that it's striking and it's hard to believe. And that again was kind of when newspapers were now focusing on blowing, you know, they had a crime that they could blow up, and it was covered in every newspaper in the country. There were people from England, Japan, France covering it, newspaper reporters. And only one or two people said, hey, is she really guilty at age 14? Could she really have participated in these crimes? And Carol served, as I said, 17 years in prison. And she, when I started the story, she had disappeared. She, when she got out, she led a totally normal life. She got married. She served in the same, worked at the same job as a medical assistant as a hospital for 25 years and then retired. Never had any kids. But no one knew where she was. Her lawyers didn't know. Her friends didn't know. I finally found her through a stroke of somebody decided to tell me that did know. And I went up and before I found her, I was kind of like, well, that's too bad, you know, but I really don't need Carol. I know the facts of her life probably better than she does by now. And I knew she'd had a stroke and had been damaged in a pretty beat up in a car accident and wasn't, you know, completely present. And, but every time I talk to somebody, particularly a journalist, they'd say, have you seen Carol? Have you seen Carol? And I'd say, no. So finally, when I got the chance, as soon as this guy called me, I jumped on a plane and flew to where she was, which was a nursing home, got into the nursing home and was talking to her for about an hour. And finally, some of the help there, the woman who ran the place came in and said, challenged me and said, who are you? And I said, hurry, well, we just talked to the guardian and they want you to leave. So I was thrown out of the nursing home, but I had an hour's time with Carol, which was quite meaningful to me and quite appropriate for the ending of the book as well.
I would just add to your point, and you point this out in the book, that this was a time before criminal defense protections like the Miranda Escobedo decisions, the Gideon decisions. So, yeah, it was a different time when law enforcement held a lot of the cards with criminal defendants. But I wanted to get to one more topic here. We got about 4 minutes. But you talk about how this changed America. But also, I mean, I came upon this through the Bruce Springsteen album, Nebraska. That's how I first became aware of this, and had a guest on last year that wrote a book on this, on Springsteen's work in Nebraska, which Springsteen calls his most important work. But it also led to a production of some movies. But just talk about how this, from a cultural aspect, how this changed our society.
They became mythic. Well, first of all, the movie that came out first on it was called Badlands, and Martin Sheen played Charlie and Sissy Spacek played Carol. That kind of started this whole cultural phenomena of kind of romanticizing them, kind of like Bonnie and Clyde. You know, they weren't particularly seen as evil. It was the basis for Natural Born Killers. It was the inspiration for Natural Born Killers. It was the inspiration for Stephen King. He's written about the impact of Charlie Starkweather on him and his horror writing. Billy Joel sings about it. And in all of these presentations, he's never presented as evil. It's kind of, part of it is the girl and the boy thing of it, and part of it is they're fleeing from the cops. And then Bruce Springsteen comes out with it, and he mythologized. It's a great song. I mean, it's the title of the album, and the great song is, it's haunting. I mean, it haunts me today when I listen to it, particularly after having gone through and relived all of the murders. It's very powerful and very haunting, but it's told through Charlie's mind and through his voice. So he's never condemned. He's almost leads you to feel a little bit of sympathy for him. That might be too big a word, but it certainly kind of hints that there's some sort of understanding of him and what he did.
I agree.
That continued with another show called Murder in the Heartland with Roth. I can't think of the first name right now. Not Philip, but Tim Roth. Tim Roth played Starkweather. And it's kind of continued. There are a lot of little flameouts from it here and there. You see a lot of junk on YouTube about it. But one of the things I wanted to do was take the romantic aspect out of it and take the reader through the murders and said, this is what he did. This is the pain that he caused. And this is the impact on relatives and children of those that were murdered. So we could look at the thing a little bit more honestly than it had been presented in the culture.
Yeah, Billy Joel mentioned Starkweather in his song, We Didn't Start the Fire. Again, I wasn't aware of that. So, Harry, we're out of time, but I want to thank you again for taking the time to be with us. I'll just mention to our listeners as well, this book is called Starkweather, The Untold Story of the Killing Spree That Changed America. I'll also mention that Harry also wrote a true crime book called In Broad Daylight about an incident in northwestern Missouri. Small town that's next on my reading list. I'm not going to tease any more with it. Just if you're interested, look up Harry McLean. It's McLean, and you'll find this book. I heartily recommend it. And Harry, I'll look forward to having you back after I finish this next book.
Thanks, Robin. I appreciate the interview, and I look forward to talking to you about In Broad Daylight.
Thank you.
Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.